every day for decades, Phil Pressel, an engineer, would come home from work, and he couldn't tell his wife anything about what he'd been doing all day. Pressel was designing the cameras for a top-secret U.S. government spy satellite. For 46 years, the government kept the project under wraps, but now that satellite, known as the KH-9 Hexagon, has been declassified, and Pressel can finally talk about his life's work, and Phil Pressel joins me now in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Guy.
Phil, explain what this satellite was meant to do.
The challenge for this satellite, to design it, was to survey the whole globe. Its main purpose, actually, was the ability to verify missile silos and whatever armaments that the Russians had. And it permitted President Nixon in the early 1970s to sign the SALT I Treaty, SALT being Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty.
What was it able to verify?
It verified the number of airplanes, tanks, in one shot, because it orbited the Earth in a polar orbit. While the Earth was rotating beneath it, it could cover the whole Earth. Previous cameras took spotty pictures, and they could move tanks, move planes, and at this way we could count, I mean, the government could count everything.
It reminds me of President Reagan's famous dictum, trust but verify.
Exactly.
And this was the verify.
This was the verify.
You have described this as the most complicated vehicle ever sent into orbit at the time.
Yes.
More complicated than the Apollo missions and those vehicles.
Yes. It is believed by not only those of us who worked on it, but by experts in the government and in industry that it still is the most complicated thing ever put up in orbit, because it had film, and it was the last film recovery system that was used for
reconnaissance.
Actual film. It was all mechanical and, most importantly, electronically controlled. The servo mechanisms controlled the speed of the film relative to the image of the Earth.
Okay, if this was orbiting the Earth and taking pictures on film, how did you actually get the film back to develop it?
The film canisters were sent back to Earth in a re-entry vehicle that re-entered the atmosphere just like the astronauts used to do.
It was just launched out of the satellite.
Right, and then at around 50,000 feet, a parachute slowed it down, and a C-130 airplane caught it in midair over the Pacific.
Wow.
Brought it back to Earth, and then it was developed.
Phil, you actually were not born in the United States. You came
I was born in Antwerp, Belgium.
You came here as a child. After the war.
Yeah. I'm basically a Holocaust survivor.
Could you ever have imagined that you would, as an adult, live in the United States and take part in what clearly was a critical program for the United States and its efforts during the Cold War?
Absolutely not. I couldn't even conceive of living anywhere else but in Europe.
Phil, I noticed you have an iPhone. And as you know, right here in the studio, you and I can go on your iPhone using Google Earth, and we can locate pretty much any location, at least in cities around the world. You can really zoom in. I can find your house. You live in San Diego. That is pretty incredible technology. And if you think about it, it's available to everybody now.
Right.
And your technology was just available to a secret select few people. Yes. Could you have imagined that we would come this far?
Could not imagine it. And the other thing is that we did all of this incredibly complicated work with slide rules, without microprocessors, without solid-state electronics, without CCDs, LEDs, and we used old technology, and it worked.
That's Phil Pressel. He designed the cameras for the recently declassified KH-9 Hexagon spy satellite. He joined me here in the studio. Phil, thanks for coming in.
You're very welcome. Pleasure.
40 years ago, a novel set off a controversy which soon grew into a film and then a firestorm. The Exorcist by William Peter Blatty told the story of a little girl named Reagan at a time when Richard Nixon was president. It was the daughter of a Hollywood star who's shooting a film in the Georgetown neighborhood of Washington, D.C. Funny things start happening in their rented house. They hear noises in the wall. Reagan starts speaking in a growl, levitating, spinning her head around and spitting up green slime. Unusual behavior, even for a 12-year-old. Then, her bedroom gets as chilly as a frozen foods case, and her bed starts flying around the room. Not exactly Mary Poppins, is it? 40 years after The Exorcist hit the bestseller list, William Peter Blatty has revised, polished, and restored some parts of the book, and added a whole new character. The result? The Exorcist, the 40th anniversary edition. William Peter Blatty joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, what a pleasure to be invited to be here. Thank you.
And what made you revise a novel that has already sold 13 million copies?
When I wrote the novel, books were my love. I was a comic novelist, as a matter of fact, and screenplay writer, you know, Shot in the Dark and that sort of thing.
Peter Sellers' comedy.
Right. And the summer of 1969, I recall, at the start of that summer, comedy dried up. Mm-hmm. I could not, as the saying goes, get arrested to write. I said, what am I going to do? There is this novel I have been thinking about writing since my junior year at Georgetown. And what else have I got to do now? I'll do it. And I worked 9 months. And so at about 3 weeks away from completion, I had an offer to adapt, they call the Willingham novel, Providence Island, for the screen for Paul Newman for very, very large bucks. And I raced through the ending of the novel, and that's it. I have no time to do another draft. It was my first draft. Now, you know, I virtually prayed for a chance to do it again. And then along comes Harper and Row and the 40. I'm still around on the 40th. I can't believe that, 40 years. And I thought it was like a blessing from above.
Let me get you to read a section from The Exorcist.
Oh, sure.
If we could. Father Damien Karras, the priest psychiatrist, comes to meet the tormented little girl, Regan McNeil. And to say the least, he finds her to be not a typical 12-year-old.
Regan's eyes gleamed fiercely, unblinking, as the yellowish saliva dribbled down from a corner of her mouth to her chin, to her lips stretched taut into feral grin of bow-mouthed mockery. "Well, well, well," she gloated sardonically. "So it's you." "They sent you," she continued as if pleased. "Well, we've nothing to fear from you at all." "Yes, that's right," Karras answered. I'm your friend, Regan, and I'd like to help you." "Well, you might loosen these straps then," Regan croaked. She had tugged up her wrists so that now Karras noticed they were bound with a double set of leather restraining straps. "I'm afraid you might hurt yourself, Regan," he told her. "I'm not Regan. I'm the devil."
You do a pretty good possessed...
Thank you. I did the audiobook narration.
Is there something you learned over the past 40 years that you put into this revised version?
No. Let me be honest with you. No. It was the basics were all there. Ultimately, at its heart, it was always meant to be, the only reason I wrote it, was a novel of faith. And I have not the slightest recollection. I'm not being cute. I mean it. It's humiliating confession. I have no recollection of intending to frighten anyone at any point in time. Now to be, the terror. That's Stephen King. He's the master of terror.
So you believe in the devil? The devil incarnate?
Dick Cavett asked me that. He is the reason the book is not in the trash bin of history.
Yeah.
I must therefore tell you the story. The Exorcist, when originally published, was a disaster. Nice reviews. Lovely.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Really, I am not exaggerating. It was a disaster. Harper treated me to a farewell lunch. They sent one rep, and we lunched at the Four Seasons, and, well, the phone is brought over to the table. They want to know if you can get there in 10 minutes. It was the Dick Cavett show. They had lost a guest at the last minute. They were ready to go. I threw down my napkin, and I tore over to the studio. So I came out on stage, and Dick Cavett said, "Well, Mr. Blatty, I haven't read your book." I said, "Well, that's okay. Shall I tell you about it?" "Oh, please." I got to do 41-minute monologue. That was it. At the airport the next week, I picked up a copy of Time magazine and looked at the bestseller list fiction. What? 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 This is a mistake. It was number four. 2 weeks later, it was number one on the Times list, stayed at number one for over 4 months. It was all an accident. I still didn't plan on frightening anyone. I sleep with a nightlight, please.
William Peter Blatty was just brought out new and expanded, revised version of his mammoth bestseller, The Exorcist, the 40th anniversary edition. Thanks so much.
Oh, Mike, thank you very much, Scott. My pleasure.
Let's introduce ourselves. I'm Damien Karras.
And I'm the devil. Now kindly undo these straps.
Game 6, World Series, and last night the St. Louis Cardinals pulled out an amazing come-from-behind victory in the bottom of the 11th.
Freeze hits it in the air to center. We will see you tomorrow night.
The Cardinals' win over the Texas Rangers sent Cards fans, including NPR's Yuki Noguchi, into a state of rapture. Yuki grew up in St. Louis. She covers business and isn't generally into sports, but the Cardinals are a big exception. Here she is with a personal essay on what it means to believe.
As a kid, I developed rituals. If it was a close game, my brother and I would fall to the floor and pray with religious fervor. We'd cut private deals with the sports gods, like, I will forgo personal happiness for a week in exchange for Willie McGee stealing a base. And when the sports gods listened, we rejoiced. Announcer Jack Buck told us to go crazy, folks, and we did as the great man said. The Cardinals' unbelievable run from 10.5 games behind first place to wild card to pennant race to World Series has found me crouching, sweating, and prostrate once again to the sports gods. I'm grown up living in another city, but when it comes to critical games, baseball is all about the rituals. The rule in my house is that I only serve round or red foods for dinner on game nights. Last Saturday, the night Albert Pujols slammed 3 homers, I'd made St. Louis specialty toasted ravioli. Coincidence? I think not. I've also noticed that if I dress both my boys in their Cardinals gear, that doesn't seem to work. So I've tried alternating. If you are a true believer, you must behave accordingly. Cardinals manager Tony La Russa has his lucky necklaces. A high school friend of mine has her baby in a lucky onesie, which cannot be laundered until the Cards take the series. Last night, another friend showered every inning because you gotta do what's best for your team. Eliza Rubenstein, a fellow St. Louisan, fills her California living room with talismans that include a rally squirrel and a foam cutout of former Cardinal great Stan Musial.
We have a couple of books that seem to be good luck if we wave them at the television. One of them is a biography of Bob Gibson, and the other is a 1989 Cardinals media guide.
Rubenstein ate sprinkled donuts because Pujols likes them too. It worked once and failed once. This is hard work.
At no point do we ever reach the conclusion that what we're doing might not actually have any effect on what's happening on the field. It's always simply a matter of tweaking the rituals just a little bit more.
Rob Whiteside is a high school classmate. His offerings to the sports gods have included trading a loss by his hockey team for a Cards victory. More recently, he pledged to drink only Budweiser, the hometown brew. Did it work?
It has worked so far, yeah.
Like any true fan, Whiteside has fine-tuned the nuances of this ritual.
There has to be one open before the game starts. It's almost sort of on a 3-inning schedule. The third is open around the 7th or 8th, and it all sort of depends on when I feel like the team really needs a jolt.
Tonight's Game 7 leaves me in a quandary. Last night, my mere presence in front of the TV seemed to have a negative effect on my team. They dropped the ball or left men stranded on base. I tried putting more distance between me and the TV, following it online, going upstairs for a little while. And that's the craziest and best thing about harboring serious superstitions about your team. You feel responsible for everything good and bad that happens to them. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Our music segment today, the new Sinatra. Well, Justin Timberlake may very well be his generation's Sinatra or Gene Kelly or Fred Astaire. Don't be so quick to walk away. Dance with me. I wanna rock your body. Please sings, he dances, he acts, and in recent years, Justin Timberlake's made a name for himself in comedy bits on Saturday Night Live. In last year's film, The Social Network, he played Sean Parker, an early backer of Facebook, and Timberlake's portrayal earned him high praise from the critics. His new movie is a futuristic sci-fi thriller. It's called In Time. Timberlake plays Will Salas. He's a man who is trapped in a world where no one ages past 25 years old, and money can literally save your life. When he sat down with us recently, we asked him about his music, his life, and of course, his new film.
It's a future where time is the currency. You know, time is money, and we're able to give that money back and forth.
A man named Henry Hamilton gave me over a century. He said he didn't need it anymore. It was a gift. I'm not a thief. But hey, if you guys are looking for stolen time, maybe you should arrest everyone here.
And, you know, our lifespan is directly linked to a digital ticking clock that's on our left forearm. And when you run out of time, you die. It's about separating class by wealth.
Justin Timberlake, this is really the first time that you have played the leading character in the film. What was that like for you? Was it difficult for you?
It's funny, when you're making the movie, you're obviously not as conscious of it, and then you screen the whole thing after they finish it, and you become incredibly insecure because you're seeing your face the whole film. But I don't know. I think I wanted to play this character because I admired him. I admired his courage and his brass. So it was a lot of fun to play this character. I mean, look, you tack on getting to shoot guns and kick ass and kiss hot girls and flip cars, and it's like every boyhood fantasy.
Isn't that your real life, though?
Yeah. I shoot guns at people. I try to get in a fight once a day and just randomly kiss as many women as possible. No, you know, I think it's every boyhood fantasy trapped into one film. So, I mean, I had a ball playing this character.
Justin, the breakthrough role for you was the one you played in the film Social Network as Sean Parker. How much did that film open a whole new world for you?
Yeah, that's sort of my running joke with all of my closest friends, is that I should have a business card that says, "David Fincher put me in a movie." I obviously saw that character on the page as sort of this kind of sociopath in a way. And I felt like the biggest trick that I could possibly pull off in playing that character was sort of, for as long as possible, make the audience question who they should side with. And I feel like my favorite villains, in a way, tend to do that. And I didn't necessarily see him as a villain. I thought he had a very clear-cut point of view. And, you know, when you walk away from that film, you still have to say, you know, without the character of Sean Parker in that movie, that company never reaches $1 billion. I'm bringing sexy back.
Justin, I'm looking at a photograph that was taken of you for Vanity Fair. It ran over the summer, and you're in a hotel room. There's a beautiful woman behind you. Your tie is undone, and you're holding what looks like a glass of scotch, very sort of suave. And it just occurred to me that women like you, men like you, it seems like you don't have a problem being likable. And I'm wondering how much you think that has to do with the comedy that you've done.
I don't know. I feel like there's something to be said about feeling comfortable with what you have and don't have. And for instance, I don't think I'm particularly a great singer, but I feel like I write songs that complement my voice, you know, and I feel like it's unique. And I don't feel like I'm a particularly great actor, for instance, but I feel like I approach each thing that I do with some level of sensitivity. And I would say that comedy in general is the most disarming.
What about you, Cornelius Timberlake? What do you hope your great-great-grandson will be like?
I actually dream of a day when my great-great-grandson will bring sexy back.
bring
bring sexy back. What does that mean?
It'll be gone and he'll bring it back.
Laughter can be, it kind of breaks this wall down that I feel like people have because they might have some perception of who you might be. I guess I would definitely agree with you on that.
There's a price to pay for it. I mean, you can't walk around Los Angeles or New York or you can't really have a normal day, can you?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like I feel like I have normal days just like everybody else where I do walk around New York, and let's be clear, no one walks around Los Angeles. We all drive. It's ridiculous. But, you know, for every sort of experience I have where you feel like you might be photographed in your free time or someone might recognize you, I can add them up to days as well that you don't have that experience. And I don't know, maybe it's just that those aren't as interesting to talk about.
Justin, I know that you've been focusing on your acting career, and you haven't had an album since 2006. But there is, as you may know, an online campaign. It's called Justin Timberlake Make Music Again. One of the YouTube clips has like 400,000 views. Do you know about this?
I actually took to my Twitter to post it.
So what do you think about that?
I thought it was very funny.
Yeah. But I mean, people do want this. And of course, you know, you make your own choices. But does it ever factor into how you think about things? I mean, do you ever think, well, maybe I should start thinking about that again?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, specifically when it comes to music, I don't think that I need any persuading to think about it. It's always kind of in the back of your mind, but I think it's part of who I am and always will be, I mean, in a very cellular way. When you grow up doing, you know, one thing, I think you get to this place where you want to try new things and, you know, I do think that we live in the type of world where people get comfortable with you in one way, and so seeing you in a different way takes some time.
Hmm. Yeah. Justin, last year you did something for NPR that was more meaningful and valuable than 100 hours of me doing my show, which is you wore an NPR T-shirt, and it was photographed and published in a magazine. So I want to thank you for that.
Well, I told you, it wasn't because I thought it was hip. I actually am a really big fan.
Well, by all means, wear that shirt as much as you want.
Okay. I'll have to get a new one, you know. It's gotten some wear and tear. I actually wear it a lot, so.
All right, good. Just make sure you're photographed on those days.
I'm not sure how to do that, but you have my word. If I happen to see someone photographing me, I won't cover up the logo.
All right. That's actor and musician Justin Timberlake. His new movie, In Time, is in theaters now. Justin, thank you so much.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
Don't feel me, baby. It's just Justin. Feel good, right? Listen. I kind of noticed something when I... colorful face. It's kind of weird to me since you're so fine. If it's up to me, your face.
And for Saturday, that's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Check out our weekly podcast, The Best of Weekends and All Things Considered. You can find it at iTunes or at npr.org/weekendATC. And for audio outtakes from interviews on this program and previews of what's coming up, you can follow me on Twitter. That's at NPR Guy Raz, spelled GUYRAZ. We're back with a whole new hour of radio tomorrow. Until then, thanks for listening, and have a great night.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. The biggest thing on TV is the NFL. Of the 15 most watched broadcasts this fall, 13 were football games. NPR's Sammy Yenigun explains how the league has jumped to the top of the TV ratings pile.
American Idol is a ratings juggernaut. This year, its debut brought 26 million people to their TV screens. But the NFL is bigger. A week before, the Jets and Patriots playoff game brought more than twice that number.
Touchdown!
Right now, the networks are pushing their shiny new fall series. The most-watched drama, Once Upon a Time, got almost 13 million viewers.
I know you like me, I could tell.
But 11 million more people watched the Packers and Vikings that same day.
Unbelievable!
That was the day Matthew Corator was watching the games at Buffalo Billiards in Washington, D.C. It's a sprawling bar, teeming with buzzed football fans in their NFL jerseys. His team, the Buffalo Bills, had the day off, but he was still glued to the screen.
Well, I basically watched the 1 o'clock games, and I watched some of the 4 o'clock games, and then watched Sunday night, too.
That's roughly 10 hours of pigskin, not including the pregame shows or the postgame highlights. This year, the NFL is averaging about 18 million viewers a game, and their success has to do with the fact that they have a lot of fingers in a lot of pies.
Within their business, they have .com, which is separate than their NFL shop, which is separate than their fantasy league and their women's apparel.
All of those subsidiaries generate more interest in watching games on television, says Tor Myron. He runs Gray New York, the NFL's advertising agency, and says that in recent years, the NFL has made it a point to reach out to new audiences.
What we've all realized is that women are incredibly interested in this sport, and they really haven't been spoken to much in the past. And so we've made a real large effort over the last couple of years.
Which means, ladies, there are now NFL ads in your issues of Vogue and 17. The NFL has also scored points with Latinos. Check this out. More Hispanics watched last year's Super Bowl than the last World Cup final. One big reason everyone's watching is because the games look better than ever on TV, says Michael Oriard. He's a former player with the Kansas City Chiefs and author of the book Brand NFL.
Watching it at home is so extraordinary, you know, with the slow motion instant replays, with all these camera angles.
Angles that zoom you into bone-crunching hits and fingertip grabs, which look even better on HD TVs. By now, over half of all households have an HD TV. That's not the only new technology that's helping the NFL's cause. Almost half of all Americans with a TV own a DVR player. That worries networks because they lose business when their viewers fast-forward through commercials. But NFL watchers aren't fast-forwarding through anything because they're tuning in live, says the NFL's chief marketing officer, Mark Waller.
You need to know what's happening when it happens. It doesn't have the same meaning to you if you're finding out about it a day later.
This year, the NFL's biggest commercial event, Super Bowl 60, drew 111 million viewers to the most visible show in the country's history. Sammy Yenigan, NPR News.
Probably the single greatest cause of the financial crisis and this brutal recession has been the housing bubble that burst 4 years ago.
That's President Obama in a speech earlier this week announcing a plan to help homeowners refinance their mortgages. At least 11 million homeowners in this country are underwater. They owe more on their houses than they're worth. The White House says it will help millions of people hold on to their homes through a government-backed modification program. But critics are skeptical the plan will be a success, in part because the White House is depending on the goodwill of banks to voluntarily join up. Rafael Bostic is the architect of this new plan. He is the Assistant Secretary for Policy Development and Research at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And when I spoke to him on Friday, he explained who this plan helps and who will be left out.
We have thousands of homeowners in the current environment where they just can't change their mortgage. And so they're stuck in mortgages at 6% or 7% and haven't been able to take advantage of the historic low mortgage rates. So what this program does is it really changes the criteria for deciding whether you're eligible for a mortgage. And it says we're not going to look at the amount to which you're underwater or you have negative equity, but rather we're going to look at what your performance has been. Have you paid your mortgage consistently? And if you can do that, we're going to let you just do a pretty straight, simple refinance to get from your 6 or 7% into a mortgage that's closer to the 4 and the 4.5. And what that should do is it should reduce payments fairly significantly for those families by, you know, in many instances it'll be $200, $300, $400 a month, which should then go back into people's pocketbooks and really help them stabilize their financial situation.
We've had a lot of interest from our listeners. We put out a call on Facebook about this. A lot of people aren't sure whether they qualify. Do you have to have a loan serviced by a specific provider? Does it have to be a loan that originated with Fannie or Freddie to qualify?
So for this program, it needs to be a loan that is insured by Fannie or Freddie. So it does have to be that. You know, for most people, or for many people, Fannie and Freddie are the ultimate insurers of the loan. So it's our expectation that a lot of folks who are looking for assistance will be able to qualify. And, you know, nationwide, it's our best guess that there are about 4 million mortgages that would qualify for this program. That's not to say that there would be 4 million refinances, because people have to decide what is best for them and what they can afford. There's one other thing I did want to say on this, which is another aspect of the program which people should keep in mind. What we have learned through the last couple months and years is that one barrier to refinance has been closing costs, the costs associated with title, insurance, and appraisals and the like. And through this program, we've actually reduced the cost of those things and tried to streamline the process. So the program actually deals with two important barriers, the amount of negative equity and also this amount of money you need at closing.
As you know, a refinancing is purely voluntary for banks that are not Fannie or Freddie. Why doesn't or can't the administration apply pressure to those banks to refinance more homes, particularly those banks that, you know, receive taxpayer-subsidized bailouts?
I think that the real reality here is that what banks have started to realize is that by not engaging in refinancing, they're exposing themselves to much deeper costs associated with foreclosure. What we know and what experience tells us and what bankers have told us is as soon as a property goes into foreclosure, regardless of what the market value has been, there's an extra 15% hit to the value of that property. And what that means is that you have a bunch of homes out there that are on the verge of incurring or creating significant losses on the part of banks. And frankly, I think they're concerned. The other piece here, though, is that, you know, we're talking for this program about people who are paying their mortgage. They are current on their mortgage. And so this takes a bunch of properties that would otherwise, you know, frankly, be at risk of foreclosure and really take them off the table, because we're reducing the burden and providing a deep incentive for people to stay in their house.
Rafael, as you know, this is still a crisis in this country.
Still is, yes.
Is this plan, are you confident that it is going to resolve that crisis?
By itself, I would say no. Look, we have a deep problem in this housing market. We have a bunch of people who are at risk of foreclosure. We have a bunch of foreclosures that are already out there. And we have a bunch of people who are really worried about their ability to maintain a mortgage because we have employment challenges. And so we need solutions and programs that deal with all of those. And so really gets back to this question of, are there silver bullets and are there single hits that you can do to completely heal the market? And I don't think there are, and I think that we collectively underestimated how complex the mortgage market is and how many different approaches you'd need to put in place in order to find that kind of relief.
That's Rafael Bostic, Assistant Secretary for Policy Development and Research at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Rafael, thank you so much.
It's been really good to talk with you. Thank you.